Good evening, and welcome to Good Evening, an Alfred Hitchcock podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Shea Mutella. Thank you so much for joining me. Happy New Year, everybody. Welcome to 2021. Isn't it wonderful that COVID is now completely gone, and we're in a whole new year where everything is rosy and bright and positive, and it's just, everything is just perfect.
Yes. Alternate reality.
Alternate realities.
Happy New Year, guys.
How you doing, Tom?
I'm all right. Been a very quiet year around Regina, Saskatchewan. The weather's been nice, and we haven't been visiting and traveling, which isn't such a bad thing. Just happy to be living the dream, going to work, coming home again, and just relaxing. It's been good.
Chris, how are you doing?
I am okay. It has not been as quiet and peaceful over in the UK, but I am hoping... because obviously, you know, it's New Year's. Happy New Year, everybody. I'm hoping that 2021 is at least better than 2020, which is going to make it for a very interesting chapter in a lot of history textbooks.
Yeah, there you go.
It will, absolutely. Well, I think that, I think we'll basically as a world, I'm crossing my fingers and hoping that everything will be back to like normal by September. That's my hope.
That'd be so, nice. There you go. Yeah.
We'll run a pool. We'll hold you to that.
We'll hold me. I bet you $1 million. Anywho, well, we are here to talk about something happy, something joyous, something wonderful. Murder. What a way to ring in the new year. So today we're talking about the 1950 film Stage Fright. And I think this is going to be a lot of fun. It's very interesting to find out. I've heard a lot that people seem to not like this movie because of the twist of the unreliable narrator that was in this movie. But we'll definitely talk about that later. But I think it's going to be a lot of fun. Tom, I believe you said that you had the summary.
Yeah, this is courtesy of Internet Movie Database. Stage Fright from 1950... A struggling actress tries to help a friend prove his innocence when he is accused of murdering the husband of a high society entertainer. It's the innocent man, which Hitchcock loves talking about innocent people that aren't really the murderers of people that get murdered.
Mm-hmm. And then this is kind of interesting because then it's kind of similar to, what was it, the... parroting case where that person actually is the murderer, so that's kind of interesting.
And I just, red flag, the ending is very dramatic, and I think on this one, I know Chris loves to say these films are 80 years old, but I think we should leave the ending to the viewer, because the ending is very, very interesting on this one. But, you know, we'll see how it goes throughout the show.
Well... I think we should jump into our trivia on the film, and I got a fair amount here today. So Stage Fright is a 1950 American-British film noir directed and produced by Alfred Hitchcock and starring Jane Wyman, Marlena Dietrich, Michael Wilding, and Richard Todd. The story was adapted for the screen by Whitefield Cook, Ronald McDougall, and Alma Revel, with additional dialogue by James Bridie, based on the novel Man Running by Selwyn Jepson. The release date is listed as the 23rd of February, 1950, and a running time of 110 minutes. Though Hitchcock had lived and worked in Hollywood since 1939, this mystery thriller, which is mixed with humor, was made in London locations. The only members of the cast who are not British are the two top-billed stars, Wyman and Dietrich. Featured is an original Cole Porter song, The Laziest Girl in Town, performed by Dietrich in a sultry fashion. And, you know, guys, let's just talk about that for a second. What did you guys think of the song with Marlena Dietrich singing about that? Chris, what did you think of the song?
I mean, it's a song that, I'll be honest, has been stuck in my head ever since I heard it many years ago. but not necessarily in a good way. But not in a bad way either. It's one of those where it's just like, it's not because I couldn't, it's not because I shouldn't. And it's just, I think it's a very interesting one, and it makes sense in context of the character and in terms of the plot and everything. And it's interesting because it's one of the few times where Hitchcock will direct what is effectively a musical sequence. You know, mm-hmm. it is diegetic sound, it is, people are listening to it and all that sort of thing, but it is interesting in the sense of its character building as well, because you get to know a bit about who Marlene and Dietrich's character, Charlotte Inwood, who she is and her perception, and so whether or not she is guilty of the crime in which she has been implicated. So yeah, I enjoyed it. It's not going on my iPod anytime soon. But I don't mind it. It's perfectly fine.
That's funny. Tom?
Again, it's kind of like on Happy Days when they would have a band on the show. Chris, I know you've never seen the TV show Happy Days.
I was going to say, I'm like, I've heard of Happy Days. I've never
but
seen
it's it. But like, it's like, it's kind of like in the middle of a movie, we're going to have a musical number, which is fine because people would enjoy it. And it's true to what her character is. She plays a songstress, like a star of the stage. So why not let her character actually do a song during the film? And we can actually enjoy kind of a musical interlude during the film. I don't mind it so much. But yeah, it is a very catchy song and very provocative song. And it was, I enjoyed that part of the movie. I think it was worth it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, see, for me, like, she's known that she's done some singing, right? Like Marlene Dietrich. So she's kind of known for singing. And to me, it kind of throws me out of it. Like, I recently watched the original Ocean's 11. And with the Rat Pack in it. And I mean, you got the Rat Pack in it, so there's singing in this movie, right? And it's like, it kind of throws me out of it. It's just a gimmick because of who's in the film to me. So I wasn't really a big fan of the singing sequence. But I mean, I think I liked it more in this movie than I did in Ocean's 11. But yeah, I could have left it. I would have been fine if it wasn't in the movie. So. Anyways, I was just curious on your guys' perception of the song sequence. Listeners, let us know what you think. Send us a tweet or comment on the Facebook page. So Dietrich also begins a performance of Edith Piaf's La Vie en Rose, but is unable to finish it after being startled by a Boy Scout bringing a blood-stained doll to her. Dietrich's costumes were designed by Christian Dior. Dietrich was allowed an unprecedented control of her shots by Hitchcock during the filming. When asked during the filming about working with the famously controlling and technically adept Dietrich, Hitchcock replied, "Everything is fine. Miss Dietrich has arranged the whole thing. She has told them exactly where to place the lights and how to photograph her." Later, he said of Dietrich, "Marlene was a professional star. She was also a professional cameraman, art director, editor, costume designer, hairdresser, makeup woman, composer, producer, and director." Stage Fright garnered some adverse publicity upon its initial release due to the lying flashback scene near the beginning of the film. However, some film critics, including those of Kaieda Cinema, see the flashback as simply being an illustration of one person's version of events. The events as recounted by the character whose voiceover we hear, which was presumably Hitchcock's intention. The film has a few extra long takes, reminiscent of those that Hitchcock used in Rope and Under Capricorn, both films produced by Hitchcock for Transatlantic Pictures in partnership with Sidney Bernstein and released by Warner Brothers. Stage Fright was originally intended to be a transatlantic release, but became a Warner's release instead. The biography of Dietrich by her daughter said that Dietrich did not particularly like Jane Wyman, perhaps because they were such opposites. Now, Jane Wyman was born Sarah Jane Mayfield on January 5th, 1917, and she was an American actress, singer, dancer, and philanthropist. Her career spanned more than seven decades. She was the winner of the Academy Award for Best Actress for the 1948 film Johnny Belinda. She was also the first wife of actor Ronald Reagan, later the 40th President of the United States. They married in 1940 and divorced in 1948. Wyman's professional career began at age 16 in 1933 when she signed with Warner Brothers. Wyman followed common practice at the time when she added 3 years to her age. A popular contract player, she frequently played the leading lady, her roles including starring alongside William Hopper in Public Wedding, Ronald Reagan and Eddie Albert in Brother Rat from 1938, and its sequel, Brother Rat and a Baby, from 1940, Dennis Morgan in Bad Men of Missouri, Marlena Dietrich in Stage Fright, and Sterling Hayden in So Big from 1953. She was also featured opposite Rock Hudson in Magnificent Obsession, which is a fantastic film, and All That Heaven Allows, which is also really, really great. Both of those were directed by Douglas Sirk. She was a 3-time winner of the Golden Globe Award, and she achieved continuing success in the television soap opera Falcon Crest from 1981 to 1990, in which Wyman played the lead role of villainous matriarch Angela Channing. And this is her only Hitchcock appearance. Marie Magdalene Marlena Dietrich was born the 27th of December, 1901, and she was a German-American actress and singer. Her career spanned from the 1910s to the 1980s. In 1920s Berlin, Dietrich performed on the stage and in silent films. Her performances as Lola Lola in Josef von Sternberg's The Blue Angel from 1930 brought her international acclaim and a contract with Paramount Pictures. Dietrich starred in many Hollywood films, including most iconically The Six Vehicles, directed by Sternberg, Morocco, her one Academy Award nomination, Dishonored, Shanghai Express, Blonde Venus, The Scarlet Empress, and The Devil is a Woman. She successfully traded on her glamorous persona and exotic looks and became one of the highest paid actresses of the era. Throughout World War II, she was a high-profile entertainer in the United States, although she still made occasional films after the war, such as Billy Wilder's Witness for the Prosecution and Orson Welles' Touch of Evil. Dietrich spent most of the 50s to the 70s touring the world as a marquee live show performer. This is her only Hitchcock appearance. Now, when we covered the film Under Capricorn, we spoke about Michael Charles Gauntlet Wendig, so we won't go over him again. But this is his final Hitchcock appearance. His only other one was Under Capricorn. And lastly, we have Richard Andrew Palthorpe Todd, he was born on June 11th, 1919, and he was a 20th century Irish actor. In 1950, he received a Golden Globe Award for Most Promising Newcomer and an Academy Award for Best Actor nomination and a Golden Globe Award for Best Actor nomination for his performance as Corporal Lachlan McLaughlin in the 1949 cinema film The Hasty Heart. His defining career role was the portrayal of Wing Commander Guy Gibson, VC, in the 1955 film The Dam Busters. This is his only Hitchcock appearance. And Alfred Hitchcock's cameo happens about 39 minutes into the film as a man on the street turning to look at Eve as she rehearses her scripted introduction speech to Mrs. Inwood.
Can we stop on that one for a bit? I was going to say that scene where Hitchcock turns and looks at her on the street recently showed up on the internet as a meme parodying the jealous girlfriend meme, where somebody has drafted in and put the third person on the right-hand side. Anyway, it has been posted on our Facebook, so if anyone's interested, they could look for that. So I just find that very interesting that a film from 1950 is still getting internet meme status to this day. And Hitchcock actually talked about that as his cameo. He said that he was told his performance in that little cameo was quite juicy. He was told this with a bit of tolerance, implying that he has now achieved the maximum limits of directorial ham in the movie sandwich. So he was kind of goofing it up a little bit in that quick glance that he makes on the sidewalk.
Excellent, right on. Well, Chris, let's go to you. You said you've seen this before, so do you remember what your initial impressions on this film were? And then what you thought now?
Yeah, so I ended up watching this years ago on terrestrial TV and catching it about halfway through and being like, oh, okay, this is cool, because there's quite a lot of recognisable British actors throughout. And I was like, oh, cool, let's watch it, that sort of thing. And then I bought the DVD, watched it through again. I was like, oh, okay, I really enjoy this. This is one of the, for a film that is ostensibly about trying to solve a murder and also cover up and you know that same murder, you know, from the murderer's perspective, it's quite light, it's quite farcical at times, it's a comedy, it's quite interesting. So when I watched it, I was kind of entertained by it, because in many ways it's quite campy. You've got, you know, you've got Jane Wyman, you've got Alistair Sim, you've got, you know, Marlena Dietrich. It's all these kind of big, larger-than-life performances. And in a way, that's basically what the film is about. It's about kind of performance and about disappearing inside a character or disappearing inside a completely different state of mind or whatever the case may be. And so, you know, the big thing that people were annoyed at, the idea of like, oh, we were given this false flashback at the start, because the film basically starts and it's Eve and I want to say Johnny, is that right? Yeah. In the car driving away, and he starts relaying, okay, thank you for picking me up, here's what's been going on. And he gives this flashback that later reveals to be false, kind of Rashomon, Usual Suspects style.
Mm-hmm.
And people were annoyed, and they were like, well, it was, you know, it was a fake out, it was, you know, similar on the lines of it was all a dream. But it's interesting because it's a spin on Hitchcock's own kind of tried and tested formula that not only has he done chronologically before several times, it also gets repeated in the future. So it's the same as Young and Innocent, it's the same as North by Northwest, it's, you know, it's Frenzy, it's the same thing of a guy is accused of a crime he did not commit, and it's up to us as the protagonists to get him out and to see him, you know, conquer over the bad guys and that sort of thing. And it's being set up so much that, oh, obviously Marlena Dietrich did it. Of course Charlotte Inwood killed her ex-husband, or killed her husband, and, you know, it's all part of this plot, and he's being framed, and we've got to go rescue him. And then it all comes out in the end that he did actually do it. He is actually, you know, the murderer, and he's been stringing Eve and her dad and the detective along. And it's just a really interesting subversion of his own type. So I don't know if it was a deliberate thing, I don't know if he kind of thought, well, here's a way to take a, you know, a story archetype and twist it around. But I thoroughly enjoyed it. I mean, for me, like I said, and it's something that comes up in The Camera Lies, which Tom and I covered, there's some brilliant character work in there. My favourite is Grenfell, who I believe in the credits is just known as Lovely Ducks.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
She's, so for those of you who aren't, because basically she was a real staple in British comedy from kind of the 40s to say about the 70s. So she would appear in like Carry On films. She appeared in the St. Trinians films. She was just a fantastic comedic character actor. And she is only in this for like this 3-minute scene where they're trying to basically win a prize for the bloodstained doll to kind of scare Charlotte. And yes, it's so funny. It's such a funny sequence. And she steals it completely. And I think that's kind of a real reason why this film works, is you get these character actors like Alistair Sim, like Marlena Dietrich, like Joyce Grenfell, who are all, you know, they might not be in the film the whole time, but they just put in such great, funny, characteristic performances.
Well, and it kind of comes across like a bit of a sitcom.
Yeah,
in the sense that it's moving very quickly. There's lots of characters. There's lots of twists and turns, and like you said, there's funny bits, and it is very different from other Hitchcock films. It is fairly entertaining, but I find you really have to follow what's going on. Like you really have to pay attention to who's zooming who, right? Mm-hmm. Who's blackmailing? Who's Eve portraying Doris, the maid, and going back and forth. It's very clever. And it is quite a fun, almost a bit of a farcical story to follow. And again, like I said, very different than what Hitchcock has done. Apparently Hitchcock himself wasn't too happy with the film. Apparently he wasn't really that happy with the technical standards of the British crew after having worked in Hollywood. But it's an enjoyable film, for sure. But like I said, you really have to follow. You have to really pay attention. Did you guys find the story hard to follow in that regard?
Well, it's tough because I've seen this once before, too. It's been a while, but the only thing I remembered was that there was an unreliable narrator. And, you know, my memory of it wasn't great. Like, for some reason, I thought... I knew his daughter, Pat Hitchcock, was in it. And for some reason, I thought Pat Hitchcock was the star of the film.
Mm.
Right? Because Jane Wyman kind of looks like Pat Hitchcock a little bit. But all I remembered of the film was that Pat Hitchcock was in it and that there was an unreliable narrator. So starting the movie, I'm like, okay, so it's this guy who's the unreliable narrator. So I can't quite remember how I originally reacted to the film. But I had that background going into the movie the second time here. You know, I'm kind of more interested to find out, Tom, like, how did you find it? Like, because this was your first watch of this film, right?
Right, right.
So, like, so the way they set it up, like a lot of people seem to have a problem with the unreliable narrator. And for me, I don't. And the reason why I don't is because most Hitchcock films, your point of view character is the innocent man. And in this story, that is not your point of view character. So we're set up that this guy's the innocent man, and we don't find out until the end that he's lying. But our point of view character is his friend that's trying to prove his innocence. And so it works for me because she wouldn't be proving his innocence if she knew that he was the murderer from the beginning, right? And if this guy doesn't want to get caught, he's going to lie to his friend to try and get helped out of the situation.
You know what I decided after watching this film is, for one, I want to find a really good podcast to listen to explain the film to me. So, you know, something, I don't know, a couple of friendly guys hosting the show, kind of a casual format podcast, and try and learn as much as I can about the show, and then go watch it a second time, because I really had a tricky time following the ins and the outs and the turns and the twists and the different characters. And maybe I shouldn't watch the films like early in the morning on the day that we podcast. Maybe I should watch them at night when I'm more awake or something. But yeah. I might have to do a second viewing on this one.
Yeah, I would say it makes more sense the second time around watching it in full.
Right.
Because once you know effectively the twist, it means, because basically the whole film is like, oh, okay, you've got Eve, you've got Johnny. Johnny is saying he's innocent, and it's Eve's kind of, because she's got a bit of a crush on him, she's like, right, I'm gonna prove that, you know, Charlotte killed her husband, and it's all backed up and everything. And it's just, it's a bit like a screwball comedy with a dark heart. It's, you know, it's a lot of kind of going back and, oh, I'm going to pretend to be a maid, and, you know, we get some of those really funny bits, like when Eve dresses up and answers her own door, and her mum just goes, oh, there you are, and just walks off. And you're like, oh, great. Because we all had a moment like that with our mothers, when you're like, oh, I'm really going to impress, and it just falls flat. And you're like, right, okay, that's absolutely fine. One thing I will say, just as an aside, because we were talking about Pat Hitchcock, who... I think she's perfectly fine in this film. I think she's great. I feel so sorry for her that her dad, the character name he gave her...
Chubby.
Not that Chubby Bannister is... That's...
But just the name Bannister, to begin with, is like... That's like a woodworking term? Like, that's part of your staircase or
something?
Yeah,
it's like a handrail, isn't it, that goes on your...
And then the chubby part? But... But would Chubby in the day have been kind of like a you're a friendly bloke kind of, you're a buddy kind of term?
Well,
or you're like a girl's girl or something? Like, I don't know. Is that like a friendly? Do we have a different definition of that?
Well, it's like that guy from that 80s. What's that 80s sitcom where his name was Boner?
Yeah.
Oh, I don't remember that one.
Oh, what was that show? There was like, I wish I could remember. I'll look it up now.
It might be one of those dated terms that we have a different impression of now than back in the day. Chris, you're better spoken on the British terminology.
That is the one thing I can provide a bit of context for. So I think it goes back to sort of boarding school 1940s and 50s, where there was a lot of, you were sort of given a nickname regardless of whether or not it matched. So it's just like, oh, well, you know, there's Chubby, there's Elfin, there's, you know, whatever. And it's just it's just a nickname that stuck. So I don't think her parents would have christened her Chubby, you know.
Yeah.
But it's a sort of body tool. No, it's like a nickname that
becomes a name.
Yeah.
The show was Growing Pains. I looked it up. It was Growing Pains.
Ah. But it's like there's a series of books called Trebizond, which are like boarding school adventure. There's a load of them in the UK, and it's that sort of thing where there's like, oh, you know, hello Minky, hello Murky, we're all gonna go off to the, you know, play field hockey, and you know, it's its own weird world.
I think so. Some of these nicknames end up being the opposite of what is true sometimes. Like, yeah. they call a big guy skinny, or they call a skinny guy
like,
tiny.
Like
or...
Little John, Robin Hood.
Yeah.
It's like, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
But no, yeah, the actual plot, I agree in that there's a lot of, like, back and forth, and because there's an extra layer of deception in there, because Eve is essentially lying to her parents, lying to her detective... love interest Smith, lying to Charlotte, lying to, you know, people. It's just lies upon lies upon lies. So it's very tricky to kind of see them all balance out, and that's why then that scene at the fair when, you know, the little trooper steps forward and he's got the bloodstained doll, and she faints and you say, "Oh, Doris, come here," and she steps out. It's such a great tense moment because they're all going, "Well, who the hell's Doris?" And Eve steps out. And you can just see the web of lies that she's constructed. Like, bing, bing, bing. They've all gone. And she's like, oh, I didn't think this through. This was a bad choice. But, and then it leads into the finale, which I know we've hinted at a bit. But I think the way the twist is revealed... is so great because you really think it's going to go one way. You really think it's going to be, well, they're going to force Charlotte into confessing, and she's going to say, yes, I did it, and Johnny will be cleared, and then whatever. But then there's the scene in the kind of, it's like a basement wardrobe department in the state, you know, in the theatre, and I think it's quite cool that it does take place in the theatre, you know, that the whole thing's about actors and performances and, you know, masks and that sort of thing. And I just love that scene. And I think the chemistry between, you know, Jane Wyman and Richard Todd just works so well there.
That scene that you're referring to where Eve and it is Jonathan, correct, that are hiding in the carriage in the props department in the basement of the theater, that is stage fright. Because they're at the stage, they're like in the environment of the theater, in the stage, literally, and they are experiencing fright. And at one point, he alludes to, what does he basically say, I've killed twice already, I might as well kill a third time, and that way they'll believe that I'm insane and I'll get off. And they show his fingertips, like he might start to choke her, and then she ducks out of, like, she gets out of that precarious scenario. So that is one example of the stage fright. I kept thinking going into the film too that, okay, if they're talking about stage fright, you know, the typical definition that everyone thinks of is performance anxiety. People are afraid of going out in public or speaking or going on stage or acting. But the stage fright is the fear that comes around being in that theater, because a lot of the drama happens in the theater itself.
Yeah, I mean, it you're absolutely right. It's also, I think, quite interesting in that you could argue that the stage fright as well is Eve's, because putting herself in the role is sort of, and you know, it's quite anxious and anxiety of, okay, I have to perform now, essentially, and lie to these people and kind of keep a track of everything that I am lying about to protect this person who, you know, she's got a big crush on. He's kind of, you know, from the kind of stuff that we can garner from their relationship, it's been a very one-sided, affectionate relationship. He likes her as a friend, but she's kind of been in love with him for X number of years or anything. And so, yeah, I can imagine it works on a number of levels. And then I suppose if you think of stage fright as kind of freezing on stage, that is something that happens at the very end when he's surrounded. He freezes. Mm-hmm. And it's then when he tries to escape that he sort of ends up accidentally causing his own demise when he slips. So,
well, and historically, to this day, the big theater complexes are dangerous environments.
Mm. Oh, God,
like,
yeah.
I know a story of Saskatoon has what's called the Centennial Auditorium, which is the big theater with the big backstage, and it's all the big productions would travel through there. They could bring in a traveling Broadway musical, and they've got all the ropes and ladders and everything in the back. And there was a scene, a true story, not even, I want to say, 10, 15 years ago, where a man fell into the orchestra pit and was very seriously injured. Cool. So this real stuff happens. Mm-hmm. And that's in the modern era, like in the 2000s or the, 2010s. Imagine the kind of horrible workplace safety risks that these people faced back in the olden days. And the theaters are a very dangerous place. And if I'm not wrong, is that safety curtain that comes up at the very beginning of the film, is that not a fire screen that would have been dropped if the stage fell on fire and they had to separate the crowd from the fire backstage?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
But those environments are dangerous. It's ladders and ropes and catwalks and pulleys and sandbags that are flying to pull curtains up and down. So it is a physically dangerous environment that I'm sure there have been deaths, similar to what we see in the final scene. Maybe not as gruesome as that one may have been, but pretty darn close to it.
Yeah. I like this a lot. Like, I like Gene Wyman's character. Going back to what Chris was saying earlier there about the layers upon layers and the tangled web that she weaved, I think it's really fascinating, and I think that Hitchcock does a very good job with, trying to balance all of this and trying to balance this complicated plot that's going on. I mean, I think it's there's a lot of things that are happening with this character that she has to deal with, and I think it's portrayed very well on screen. I mean, she's trying to prove innocence, she's trying to get information, she's being blackmailed by this maid that she's trying to get in because she's lying about who she is. There's a lot of lying that happens in this movie. Most characters are like lying to each other at a certain point in the film, and I think it makes it for a kind of a unique story in Hitchcock's work. I don't think there's any movie that quite compares to this. I think this is quite original in Hitchcock's filmography. What do you think, Tom?
No, I think that's true, and it is, like we were saying, it comes across with a bit of the farce, a bit of situational comedy. There's a lot more going on in this movie than typically happens in his other movies, and we have talked about there was some negative reviews or negative thoughts of the movie at the time, and maybe it was a little too different from what people expected from Hitchcock, that mm-hmm. people weren't available. People didn't allow themselves to like it as much.
So what do you guys think the benefit of... I've been trying to think about this while watching this film. What do you think the benefit of having this set in a theatrical, with a theatrical backdrop, does to enhance the film? Because it seems like an interesting place to set a film is with these actresses and actors and stuff in the theater.
It gives Eve a reason to be an actress.
Mm-hmm.
It allows her character to come out as an actress. And a couple of times the other men in the film tell her, oh, remember, you're acting. You're a good actress. You can do this. You're mm-hmm. playing a part, right? So it's kind of an easy way to have her character be what she is. And I don't know, does it come across like a cheap storyline or an easy way out to just say, we'll just set it in a theater because then there'll be actors and then we can have, a musical number in the middle of the film, and is that sort of an easy way out, or is that kind of predictable, or is that... What do you guys think? Like, could it have been a better environment or a better scene for the base of the film?
See, I think it's a story that's entirely dependent upon its environment. You know, it's about actors, it's about portrayal and performance, and the idea of, you know, Johnny comes across as the wine-eyed hero, and he's not. And Eve comes across like the complete innocent, and she's not. She spends most of the film being lying and deceitful. Charlotte looks like the femme fatale, and in actuality, she's not as much. Or, you know, Smith looks kind of boring and everything, and he's not. He's actually one of the more funny, enjoyable characters in the film. I think there is something to be said for the fact you get to have this... like this kind of fun and this kind of gravitas with it. So, like I said, you get to have Alistair Sim have real fun with it. You get to have these great actors having fun being actors and kind of parodying acting in a way. And it's a little bit meta in that sense, but I think because it's so theatrical and it is a story that is about the theatre and about, you know, performance, I personally think it really works. And like you said, I mean, it really helps, not exactly, let's not say cheats, but let's say kind of shortcuts, where it's not that, oh, Eve has to learn to be an actor and then go undercover as a maid. She's already studying, she's already at least competent, or she won't be, you know, studying at what is basically RADA. You know, you've got the... It ties in then to, like, how Johnny and Charlotte would have known each other, because Charlotte's, like you said, a high-end kind of performance artist. You've got Johnny, who is, you know, a fellow actor, all that sort of thing. So, it works, and I don't disagree, and, you know, it does provide some little shortcuts, and it does make it a bit easier to go, oh, well, I'll tell you what, we can have the finale in the theatre, and we can create a cool way for, you know, Johnny to go out and that sort of thing. But for me, it's quite distinct, actually, amongst Hitchcock's films, because obviously he loves a good finale, he likes a good setting, all that sort of thing, but it's one that feels quite insular. There's not, obviously, you know, the outside world, you know, similar in a way to kind of like Rear Window, where it all takes place in this little contained sphere. So, yeah, I wonder if I made sense then. I hope I did.
Well, and people in general enjoy movie stars and actresses and singers and dancers, right? Like, that's entertaining. So it gives the viewer in 1950 a chance to, oh, we're going to hang out backstage and we're going to find out about what happens in the dressing rooms and what happens, you know, with the productions behind the scenes. That's always been kind of an appealing story for people to find out about.
And I suppose we do, yeah, there are quite a few films that are, they're films about people who make films. So you have Sunset Boulevard, you have recent ones like, say, Hail Caesar, or you have even, you know, It's Just Been Christmas, it's like The Holiday, which one of the plots is about, you know, mm-hmm. one of them's a trailer maker and one's a movie composer. And they're both, it's kind of, it's an insight into how it works, but rather than, you know, it being a rom-com or a sort of dark thriller, in this case, it's a murder mystery. It's sort of right. A caper. And, you know, they do get to have fun with it. There is humour. I love Eve's family. I love the sort of spiky relationship that Eve's mother and father have. I adore it. I think it's one of the funniest sort of married partnerships, because you don't often actually see the parents of the Hitchcock heroines. If there is one, then sometimes, you know, it'll be Cary Grant's relationship with his mother, or it might be a mention of a dad somewhere. But it's quite funny right. having them both be there as this support network who are so anti each other. It's quite funny.
The Eve's mum and dad could almost have a spin-off sitcom or something, right?
Oh, they in a different world, they are in like an Ealing studio classic where it's the two of them and they're stuck together on it. Do you know what? That I can't even remember the name of it, but that bloody awful Hitchcock film we watched years ago about that awful couple, I can't remember the name of it. Mr. and Mrs. Smith. It's an early... It might be Mr. and Mrs. Smith. There was
Juno and the Peacock?
No, I mean, dear listener, you have to know, we genuinely had a conversation on Twitter where we're like, Juman Peacock, I don't remember that one. There was one where it was, was it Young and Strange? Rich and Strange?
There's so many of the films.
Young and Innocent, maybe?
Here's a question, Chris, maybe you can help me.
Okay.
And this is totally irrelevant, this is just a, a tangent. Okay. The dad, who's a charming guy, he's like a sailor, and he's well-dressed, and he's polite and stuff. So he shows up at the house, and he's got a jaunty cane that he carries, which is a nice touch. But he's carrying this little box that's wrapped in brown paper and string. And I'm like, what? Okay, the first time he shows up, I'm thinking, fine, he's showing up at his family's home. Maybe he's bringing some food over or something, but he keeps carrying this, and I want to know what that is. And anyway, I'm sure nobody knows what it is, but if anybody
I'm gonna say I'm out, there like I don't remember. Oh my god, what is he carrying?
But if you watch the film again, have a look for it. It's a little like 8-inch square brown box that he's kind of carrying every time he comes into the house, but it's irrelevant.
Okay, I mean,
it's just something that caught my eye.
I wanted to ask a question. Was that her mom? Like, I got the impression that was just somebody that she was, like, renting a room from or something like that. But, like, was that actually her mom?
I think it's her mom. Yeah, I believe so.
Is it? Okay. I can go with that.
And then the dad, I think they're separated or something.
Yeah, he said at some point he didn't like the wife.
At the shore. Well, like, he has a shore cabin. Like, he's a sailor.
Yeah. Well, it's listed, it's Jane Wyman is Eve Gill, Alistair Sim is Commodore Gill, and Sybil Thorndike is Mrs. Gill.
Well, so there you go. Do we? So let's talk a bit about Marlene Dietrich's character, because, like, I'm not quite sure how to feel about this at the end. Because, again, watching this, like, she didn't do anything wrong, but she, like, manipulated this guy into killing her husband, and then was just gonna let him float in the wind, right? Like,
she kind of laid him.
So,
at
like, I'm not quite sure. Yeah, like, how do we feel about this character? Because, like, what she did was awful, but she didn't really do anything wrong, kind of. Like, I don't know. I don't know how to feel about this.
I mean, in her last scene, she is there with the police officer, and it's there's almost like an implication of, oh, she's going to face charges for something.
But for what?
I don't know, maybe conspiracy, or maybe it's like... Well, no, because I suppose if you say, oh, helping to cover up a crime, then, like, Eve's kind of screwed then as well.
But, like, yeah, exactly. And then she was helping to cover it up because he had false evidence to implicate her.
Yeah.
Like, that's what she was covering up, right?
I suppose that's the justification, being like, oh, well, you only did what you're doing because someone manipulated you into doing it.
Yeah.
And you didn't, like, actually try and... You weren't involved in any way. I suppose it is maybe conspiracy because, yeah, I don't know. She probably got away with it. Oh, god damn.
You think, too, that maybe in the story she's a bit of a local celebrity and she probably would have got a little bit of special treatment, they would have turned their, you know, attention away from her a little bit?
Well, I you know, the guy, you know, Johnny confessed over intercom. There's no evidence for Charlotte. She can spin this however she wants. She can say, well, you know, I didn't ask him to do it. Yes, we were having an affair and, you know, all that sort of thing, but I didn't ask him to do it. There's no evidence. The only co-conspirator is dead, thanks to a safety curtain. So...
Yeah,
she could probably just spin it away and, you know, probably doesn't go back to that town. Probably just goes and is like, right, I'll leave this little sphere and maybe goes abroad somewhere. Who knows?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Tom, anyway, what do you think?
I think she played the character well. I think she was over the top. And her character was a very good part of the film. The musical numbers were appreciated. Like, I thought it was fun to have her character. And I'm trying to separate, you know, her performance on the film versus all the stories about her being hard to deal with behind the scenes. But, no, I think that character is a very important part of the film, and she did well.
Hmm. Yeah. Excellent. Well, the only other part of the film that I really want to talk about that I found pretty interesting was, you know, in the light of the over the last couple of years with the Me Too movement and whatnot, was the portrayal of, like, how some of the men were talking to Jane Wyman's character. Like, we had a couple of instances where Marlena Dietrich's, like, right-hand butler or whatever, whoever this guy was, I guess, like, another boyfriend or something like that, was like, oh, you'd be so much prettier if you wore makeup and did your hair and all this, and you should definitely make yourself look better. And then when she goes to that bar, and there's, like, that old drunk dude who's just like, let me help you, please, I would love to help you, and she's just like, leave me alone, and he won't leave her alone. And you know, it's that fine line that, especially in this period, women kind of had to balance, because, you know, if they push back too hard, then it's like, oh, she's just a bitch, and you know, where it's just like, she just wants to be left alone, you know. So, but there was a couple of instances in this film, and I thought it's really interesting for a film from 1950 to be showing this.
When she first walked into the bar by herself, my first thought is, are women allowed in the bar at all? Mm-hmm. And then I realized maybe women are allowed with an escort, like with a man, or is it just, if a woman shows up in that bar, she's on her own, like she's going to be treated in a certain way, like she's not going to really be comfortable. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that man that was bothering her was quite insistent and quite a bit of a jerk to her. But she turned it around and kind of, mm-hmm. she was very strong in her personality in the bar, because she was able to tell that old guy to get lost, and then she basically was there to try and build a relationship with the detective and to learn about the matters of the police investigation. So she was a very strong character in the scenes in the bar, because she did turn it around and managed to pull him into her web.
I think you are right in the sense of, I think back then it would have been a case of, if a woman goes into a pub, which would have been like a working class, you know, go sit down, have a drink, I think she would have been, not necessarily on her own, but there's a certain level of, you know, behaviour that I think they would kind of like, right, well, I've just got to deal with this. It's the equivalent of, you know, oh, well, if you're a secretary, sometimes the boss will, you know, pinch you on the bum, and you don't say anything, because you don't want to be seen as awkward when you just, you know, women are only really starting to enter the working world en masse properly, kind of around about that time. I think, fortunately, the first instance mentioned where it was, I think his name's Freddy, is the creepy, Charlotte's creepy kind of assistant, boyfriend, paramour, whatever. I think that not necessarily works, but because he is creepy, you do kind of side yourself immediately with Eve going, well, yeah, that's gross, that's disgusting. Oh, you look better with makeup. Well, you know, you'd look better out of the film. So,
like if he did that to a woman today, he would have been smacked.
I think
or told,
he
right?
would have been hashtag cancelled, and rightfully so. But the second one, I think it's a bit ickier because it's played off as comedy. You know, he's supposed to be, oh, he's a harmless old guy, but he does it twice. You know, she says twice, like, I don't need help. Will you please just go away? I do not want to talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
You know. And she does batter him off, but, yeah.
The only aspect of a man telling a younger woman, you should do your hair differently, you should dress differently, that would be appropriate in this film would be in the theater setting, in a sense. Within limits, where the man, if, you know, if it was a, for this character, you know, your character should be wearing this kind of outfit or having this kind of haircut. But that's not, this is a social situation. It wasn't in the theater. Yeah. So that
yeah,
does
even
make
somebody,
it
if it's a sense of, oh, hi, for this role, could you cut your hair, or you're going to need to wear makeup on the stage, or that sort of thing. But yeah, any other kind of circumstance, it's very much a case of, this is weird and, it's almost a bit kind of that negging behaviour, which is like, oh, you'd be so pretty if you wore makeup. And you're like, that felt like a compliment, but it tasted like an insult. You know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I know, I'm sticking that on a t-shirt. It sounded like a cop-out, but it tasted like an insult.
If you would in that era of this, if you were in that film in 1950 and you used the word hashtag, they'd probably hand you a plate of like potatoes and eggs and sausage with a sticker. Well, they wouldn't know what hashtag was. Anyway, I'm joking.
They'd be like, how do you? In the UK, there's corned beef hash, and it'd be like that, and it'd be like this.
Hashtag.
This is what you mean.
Anyway, Brandon,
that they stopped serving it.
Brandon.
Yes,
can
sir.
You get this train back on track, please?
I don't know. I think it's an interesting discussion on how the woman was being treated in the film. So, but I mean, beyond that, I don't have much to add to the film. I think the film's good. It's not my favorite Hitchcock by any means. Tom, is there anything else that we haven't discussed yet that you'd like to address?
No, I'm good. I think we've covered everything quite nicely.
Mm-hmm. Chris, anything you want to talk about?
No, I think we've covered it all. I think if you are considering looking, you know, trying Hitchcock, that sort of thing, I think it's a fine one to get into as like an entry point. It's very different to a lot of his darker material or more serious material, but it's fun. It's light. There's a lot going for it, and there's some recognisable names that I think might be a decent draw if you're like, oh, well, I'm not going to go see one that people have never heard of, but, you know, Marlene Dietrich's in it, Jane Wyman's in it, Alistair Sim's in it. You know, you can have, you know, you can. It's a very cosy Sunday afternoon sort of film, and I think a lot of people will enjoy.
That's interesting. I definitely would not put this as like an entry point for Hitchcock. I think this would be one that would be better for people who'd seen a few of his, because, you know, Hitchcock's known for a certain thing, and he deviates from this. He deviates from that in this film, right? So, as an entry point for Hitchcock, I don't think I'd recommend it. I mean, it's good. I wouldn't say avoid the film. But, yeah. Tom, did you want to give it a rating? Do you have a funny rating you want to give it?
I will give it 3 out of 5 glorious, stunning white leather Shea lounges draped incrementally up a very glamorous stage in a theater. That's a reference to her musical number.
Chris?
4 out of 5 lovely ducks that you've got to shoot, because otherwise you won't get that bloodstained doll.
Awesome. I'll give it 4 out of 5 dolls with bloody dresses. So that's what I'll give it. So. Awesome. Well, that's all we got for this week's discussion of The Stage Fright. I'd like to thank the guys over at the Fandom Podcast Network for hosting our show on their network. You can find our show in their feed as well as in our own independent feed. Please check out our friends Annie and Catherine and their show Good Evening and Alfred Hitchcock Presents podcast, where they go over all the episodes of Alfred Hitchcock Presents in kind of a random order. It's a lot of fun. So with their show and our show combined, you can get a near comprehensive look at the Grand Master's work. Thank you so much to Jason Cullimer for our wonderful theme music. We absolutely love it. And yes, until next time when we cover Strangers on a Train, which I'm looking forward to revisiting for the first time in a really long while. Tom, where can people find you when you're not trying to pretend to be a maid?
I keep things tidy and clean, and I'm always sweeping up and dusting over on our Facebook page. We like to encourage people to follow us on Facebook and participate and comment and subscribe and share and like. We really just, it's all about being liked for us. So I hope people are able to participate and follow us over there.
Chris, where can people find you when you're not falling deeply, madly in love with Jane Wyman in the back of a car?
Oh. Hi, I'm Chris Haig, and I'm the laziest girl in town. You can find me. What you don't know is I did like the little hand thing as well. You can find me on Twitter at @higher_boy, where I will be. I mean, if it's coming out on New Year's Day, I'll be looking forward to the election. I'll be praying that the coronavirus has left, and I will be just chatting about all kinds of stuff. So come say hi.
Mm-hmm. And as for me, you can find me on Twitter at Brandon Metella. You can find me out there with three podcasts. I've got Infinite Diversity, which is all about new Star Trek. And you can find me on Franchise Fatigue with my friend Zach. We cover movies, remakes, and sequels. And then our film series, House of Fincher, has finally finished. Mank finally came out. And we are now transitioning to House of Nolan. So watch for that this month. We're going to be starting with Christopher Nolan, and tonight's going to be a lot of fun. We're discussing Interstellar tonight, which I think is probably my favorite Christopher Nolan film. I really like that movie quite a bit. So, well, that's all we got for you tonight. Until next time, good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Red Flag, the ending is very dramatic, and I think on this one, I know Chris loves to say these films are 80 years old, but I think we should leave the ending to the viewer, because the ending is very, very interesting on this one.
What do you mean, when they cut the guy's head off?
Yeah, that part.